appreciate very much the attendance of everyone and our format. Lauren, help me remember where we left off.
Landon answered the last one.
Okay, so what we're going to do, we're going to go around and I'll call on one of the men to answer the question. If you'd like, if you'd rather pass, you have that option, certainly, to pass as well. Yes, thank you, Mark. Levi reading. And again, Judges chapter 8. Try to keep it moving tonight and not dally around too long. Let's see. Okay, Levi, question number one. If you like it, why are the men of Ephraim upset with Gideon? What is it about Gideon's response that calms them down?
Yeah, why were they upset? Probably a mix of a lot of different things. One could have been greed. There's obviously money involved with pillaging places. I think it was there was a large part of it that was pride. We all know how it feels to be left out of certain things, and from our study last time, realizing how awesome what Gideon did, breaking all the lanterns, and breaking all the jars that had the lanterns in them. That was really cool, and to be a part of that would have been a pretty awesome deal. So they might have been mad about that. What is it about Gideon's response that calms them down? Proverbs 15:1 says, a soft word turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. So they got to get all these kings because they were coming in the later part. They got Midian, Oreb, and Zeb. So Gideon is saying, what I did in that battle in comparison to what you guys got to do, mine is worse. So he's cool-headed here. And the Spirit of the Lord is upon him here. And he has said some wise words
here. So. Yeah, it's very insightful of him to be able to try to lift them up and brag on them a little bit and not take the glory for himself. Something I had intended to do. Let's see if I can do this again. Trying to remember where we were at. You remember we just had a big battle right in here. We had a big battle. Mount Tabor, and here's Tabor over here. We have the different tribes, Naphtali, Asher, Manasseh, come in here. Big battle. We see that the Midianites then begin to flee, and we're going to be approaching Ephraim here, and they're going to be trying to get involved, and they help, but it also creates conflict, as we've seen. Not sure what's going on with this. Okay. Austin, please.
I think another motivating factor, I agree with Levi's, I think maybe an additional one is the fact of 47 years prior, Ephraim was one of the tribes that showed up in a big, big way for Deborah and Barak. They were part of that huge battle where they overthrew the Canaanites. So I think there may be a little bit of they're a little bit sore because they have a record, if you will, of being the tribe that shows up. And this was really close to their borders. They would have come. And, I think there's several reasons why they were upset. But that could be one.
Yeah, one of the reasons that I hadn't appreciated until reading from some of the other writers is the idea of booty. I mean, there's reward going into this fight. There's potential for reward going into this fight. And I found it kind of interesting that possibly those that were on, that stood back and saw that the Lord was involved here, and the Lord was seen to a victory. Now everyone wanted to get involved and have a piece of the action and possibly benefit from the plundering that would be taking place. Anyone else? Appreciate the passage that Levi referenced there in Proverbs about a soft answer, turning away wrath. Not going so good, guys.
Then you should just be able to tap the center one.
I'm tapping it. Tapping it again. Now pointing it. Now tapping it again. That's really nice slides.
You want to get the trap drive from up there?
Yeah. Side to side, huh? We'll try it from up here. Hopefully it'll work. I found this interesting. Judges chapter 12. Bart and I were talking about this last week, how there's been a couple of times that we're going to see Ephraim complain about not being invited to the fight. And This is another opportunity for them to complain. And they threaten Jephthah, as we can see here. And Jephthah doesn't like it. And it cost the tribe of Ephraim dearly. I really like this map. It's called a relief map, I believe. Again, we're talking about the initial fighting was right here. And the reason I brought this map into play for us, our consideration, is trying to appreciate the terrain. West of Jordan, Ephraim was brutal. The fords, we'll read about fords, the valleys, the ravines that were feeding down into Jordan. And as we talked a couple of weeks ago, the Kishon River, somewhere right through here in the chapter 4 battle, runs down to Mount Carmel, I believe it is, out on the coast. So we can see right now we're down in here. Ephraim's upset. The tribe of Ephraim's upset. Gideon's been, and his 300 men have been chasing the remnants, that 15,000 that were running in the two kings. So I thought that might be helpful. Anything else? Anyone else got any comments? All right, question number 2, Cole, if you're up for it. Where is Succoth and Peniel? Why did they refuse to help Gideon and his men? What did Gideon threaten to do to them once the kings of Milan were captured?
I said you have a map.
Oh, man, have I got a map. Oh, don't use that.
Okay, so, yep. Succoth and Peniel are on the eastern side of the Jordan River. So, for question B, why did they refuse? And then they were just afraid. They probably heard a story about the 300 men defeating all those Midianites. And they thought, well, that must have been some fluke. Soon these Midianites are going to gather their senses and just destroy these people. We don't want to be a part of that. We don't want them to destroy us.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty sure that was a thought process.
Mm-hmm.
And for part 3, what did Gideon threaten to do with them? Destroy them. In verse 7. For this cause, and the Lord has delivered Zebon, Zalmunna into my hand, and I will tear your flesh with thorns of the wilderness and with briars. Right. Not sure what that term means, but it is some sort of total destruction.
I thought of it like a scourging with briars. And, okay. Anyone else got anything to add to question number 2?
Bart?
Yeah, so, you know, in these guys' defense, which there's not much of a defense, but they are on the east side of Jordan, and the Midianites come up first against them. And so they're a little bit more exposed. Remember, these are the two and a half tribes that stayed back when the rest went in. So it's Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh are these people, the ones that promised Moses and Joshua that they would be faithful to the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got a tiny little excuse, like a 1% excuse, but not much, because they're not supporting Israel. They're not supporting Israel's deliverer. And you know, he's not asking much. Gideon's not asking much. He's asking for bread and water. He's not saying, he didn't say, give me soldiers to go with. He's just wanting some support. And there are many times in the Bible where the brethren of the Lord ask for bread. And one of them is David. There's a time in David's life, King David, when he's on the run from Saul, that he asks for bread. He goes to the high priest in Shiloh and asks for bread. And we're told in the New Testament that if we don't give bread to our brother, then we're going to be lost. That's one of the things Jesus says. If the least of these, if you give bread and water to the least of these, then you will receive a reward in heaven. So in a way, this has many topical elements that affect us. It's emblematic when you have brethren that ask you for help or assistance that are in need, and you turn away from them, walk away from them, then the Lord finds you guilty. And that's what happens here with these two. One other thing I'd like to notice is Penuel. Penuel means the face of God. And this is the location where Jacob wrestled the angel of the Lord.
Mm.
So it's a big moment. And Jacob is emblematic of the entire nation of Israel. And he wrestles with the Lord at Jabbok River there, Penuel. And then that Israel means one who wrestles, the prince who wrestles with God. And so these men of the city, they're living in this place where Jacob wrestled with the Lord, are again wrestling with God. Because God's saying, here's my deliverer, support my deliverer, be faithful to my deliverer, give him food. And they say, no, we're not going to have anything to do with him. So that's why they're punished so harshly.
Yeah, very good. Very good. I forgot about the Penuel. Thank you. Anyone else? Question number two. I thought kind of along your lines, Cole, with the Midianites having gone through this area, Gideon and his 300 after him, and these cities are under Midian control, have been under Midian control up to this very moment, and I believe that they were maybe threatened and did not want to spill the beans and tell Gideon and his troops where they were at. I saw that as another reason why they wouldn't have said or wouldn't have supported or wouldn't have offered any bread. They might have been threatened by the kings of Midian as they went through that area. Just a thought. I don't know if it's right or not, but it seems plausible. Anyone else on question number two? All right, question number three, Austin, if you're up for it. Oh, there's your men of Succoth getting whipped with a briar branch. I can't even imagine. That'd be pretty rough. Okay, question number three. Where did Gideon attack the army? What did Gideon and his men have to do to capture Zebah and Zalmunna? What did Gideon do to the men of Succoth and Penuel?
So they're in Succoth, Penuel, and I believe that's Jagbehama.
Yep.
Okay, so it says there, let's see, verse 11, they went up the road by those who dwell in tents on the east side of Nobah and Jagbehama. And then the armies were down in Karkor. And I couldn't find a good map to show where Karkor was.
I'm glad to hear that, because I couldn't find one either.
But
it's down here somewhere.
It seems
down here somewhere.
It's the most plausible place for Karkor to be. And I think in some ways, it's hard to describe or put on a level whether chapter 7's route of the Midianites, the 120,000, we know for sure that it says the Lord turned their swords against one another and they started killing themselves. We're told here in this chapter it's 120,000 men that fall right on that side of the river. 15,000 more men are still present. They're still raring to go. But they're fleeing. They're down there in Karkor. And Gideon and his 300 go in there and they slaughter them all.
Same 300.
The same 300, more significantly. So I don't know which one is cooler or which one. We know for sure that the Lord's victory is, I think we can obviously say that that is probably the coolest. But in a certain sense, it's incredible to think that these 300 go in there. They take out 15,000 men, and it says there they routed the whole army. This yep. wasn't just some after many days, and they starved them. They went in there and completely destroyed them. And then they go on and they pursue Zeba and Zalmunna. They catch them because they flee the scene. They know they're going to lose. They get out of there, but they track them down anyway. And then they take these two kings as captives of war. So they go back to Succoth and Penuel, and Gideon does to them exactly what he said he was going to do when he captured them. So there's a certain degree that you can look at the faith of Gideon in God, because one might think, again, you're coming up with 300 exhausted men against yep. 15,000,
yep.
and he didn't bat an eye. He said, I'm going to do this, and when I come back, there's going to be judgment, God's judgment, that's going to fall upon you. And I really like how Bart characterized this, because sometimes, I know for myself, when I was reading this, I'm thinking, well, these are just pagan people. No, these are Israelites. These are people that should have been on their side. They should have supported them in whatever they were doing. And they failed to do that. John Gill, and I don't know how true this is, but he suggested that Succoth means briars or thorns or something. So the possibility that there was a bunch of thorns and briars around the city or in the area, and that's why he gives the punishment that he does. So he goes in. It's also interesting, he catches a young man, he says, and interrogates him, gets him to write down the names of the 77 leaders,
right.
77 men, the leaders of Succoth, and he goes, he grabs all of those men, and says that he taught the men of Succoth. So it's debated on what exactly that means, to be taught. We know what happened in Penuel. He goes, he tears the tower down. It's presumed that maybe they were in the tower at the time, the men of Succoth, and he kills them. And it's likely that he also kills the men of Succoth. Although it's said we can debate what it means to be taught. So maybe they were just beat half to death with thorns and briars. Like you said, I can't hardly imagine that. That would be gruesome enough. And I think this is very interesting when you get into chapter 9, because we're going to read about a tower in chapter 9. We're going to read about some other punishment that's not so God-ordained. And also, he only punishes the men. He doesn't go in and destroy the whole city. He doesn't kill women or children, but he does bring God's judgment upon evil, wicked men that refuse him.
Yeah. Yeah. I got from Karkor up to Succoth, that's supposed to be 10 miles. So you think about Succoth back up to the original battle, these men have had a long day or couple days. This has been quite the battle. They've had a big march on their hands, and they're definitely distressed. Anyone else question? Bart, please.
Yeah, so it's interesting, in verse 13, Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from battle from the ascent of Peres. If you looked in the King James, you saw a difference in translation. The King James says, before the sun arose. Gideon returned from battle before the sun arose, instead of the ascent of Peres. And it's also in the Young's literal translation that way. I checked there. And so that translation, because Peres means sun, And that translation suggests that Gideon attacked the Midianites in Karkor at night when they thought they were safe. Because it says in verse 11 maybe. Yeah, he attacked them while their camp felt secure.
Yes.
And so if you take that translation from the KJV and Young's Literal, he attacked at night. And then he returned all the way back at night. So perhaps that helps explain why they were so successful. Obviously, the help of the Lord in killing everyone. And then I couldn't help but just comment that this is, it's got some elements of the Lord's return in AD 70 on Jerusalem. Because the Lord returned upon Jerusalem, which were brought up, they were Israelites who refused to support the anointed deliverer, and Jesus promised that he was going to return. And when he returned back, remember Matthew 24, he gave a sermon setting on the Temple Mount, and he said, "Not one stone will be left upon another when I return. This place will be torn down." And that's exactly what the tower was torn down by Gideon, and the temple torn down by Jesus, and then Jesus did the same thing to the city of Jerusalem that Gideon does to these two cities, because they refused to accept the anointed Lord.
Yeah, very good connection. Appreciate that. Anyone else? Question number three. Lauren?
What I've also looked at here is that in verse 11, while the camp felt secure and he pursued it, let's see, what's it? Gideon went up by the road of those who dwell in the tents on the east of Nova and Jogba. So it also appears that he may have circled the camp and come back from the east, coming from the direction they weren't expecting. Hmm.
I wondered about that too, the road and how that played. I wasn't able to connect it as far as circling around and coming back to the east, but that sounds like a very real possibility. Anyone else on question number three? We're going to have to keep moving. Question number four. What had Zebah and Zalmunna done that caused Gideon to kill them? Why is the inaction of Gideon's son recorded for us? What are the crescent ornaments that were on the camels' necks? This is verses 18 through 20. Hunter, you want to pass. Grant, would you like?
Sure. We see in verse 18, he said to Zebah and Zalmunna, "What kind of men were they whom you killed at the table?" So they killed the people there that he's kind of asking about here. So what had they done to cause Gideon to kill them? Well, they first killed them, and he went ahead and said, "Okay, were you the ones who did this?" Wanted to make sure that it was them before you can act a judgment on them, to make sure that it was a just judgment, essentially. Which speaks well to the character. Why is the interaction of Gideon's son reported for us? I'm not too sure about this. Either it's to show that generally they're not a very brutal family. They're not really a warmongering family. They're just kind of a normal family that kind of has been put in this position. And then Gideon asks his son to do this, which I think is a little bit awkward. That kings of the time would probably do in order to try to build up their son's manhood, to try to make them a better leader, to have their son kind of take this role. But that doesn't seem to be part of what they normally do. If you're wondering why they're court for us, I don't know. I'm just kind of taking a guess at that. And what are the crescent ornaments that were on candles next? I'm not too certain on this either. My guess is that it kind of has a sign of nobility for those who were taming at the time, and then when to show that the people who were riding camels were of nobility or a king or a chief or something, and that when Gideon kind of took this, it was also a sign that he had won victory over the people, to show that he was that God really did put him in his hand.
Very good. Found some examples. I mean, some of the pictures I found, they really decked out their camels. I had some amazing, I mean, these were modern pictures as well, and it was very impressive what these guys did with their camels. This is thought to be an example of a crescent
that would hang right here, and then they would join the back with a leather strap or a rope, or a gold chain, or something of that nature to dress up their camels. Anyone else on question? Lauren.
So in verse 19, he says, they were my brothers, sons of my mother. So there are some of the, at least Adam Clark theorizes that perhaps some of these men of paper were part of Gideon's family. Now, Keel kind of suggests that Gideon wanted to disgrace the king by letting a boy kill him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as we were reading this earlier, I also wondered if in fact they were part of Gideon's family, if Gideon wanted his son to do this as avenger of blood for their murder, his vengeance. Not that also the camels thing would be pretty interesting. So this crescent is often an ancient fertility symbol, and that would play into the Baal Asherah worship. And today you still see this crescent moon on Islamic flags. It originally seems like it came from the Mesopotamian god of sin.
Yeah, very good, very good. I also found that very interesting. I want to throw this out as a possibility. I got to wondering about this second part. Why is the inaction of Gideon's son recorded for us? To me, it seems very unlikely that Gideon's son, under the age of a soldier, would have traveled and been part of this 300. He was still a youth. So I think Gideon's son was still back at Ophrah. And maybe this bit of information is telling us that Gideon took these two kings all the way back to Ophrah so his son could kill him. Maybe he had that plan all along, I'm not sure. But with his son being mentioned here, it seems to me like a real good possibility that he went all the way back with these kings, back to his hometown. Just a thought. All right, let's keep. Okay, quick. Okay, question five. Let's do question five. Why did Gideon refuse to be king over Israel? And what does this say about his faith? Why did Gideon make an ephod out of the earrings of the Ishmaelites and other trophies of war? What effect did this ephod have on Israel and the legacy of Gideon? Trace?
It's kind of a three-part question.
Mm-hmm.
So the first part, I believe Gideon recognized God's supreme authority still, and to his credit. And Gideon, unlike the rest of Israel, still had faith in God and not the ways of men completely. I say that because some of these verses kind of shed a little doubt on kind of what's transpiring with Gideon and his household. So why did Gideon make an ephod of the earrings of the Ishmaelites and the other trophies of war? So that's kind of, to me, that was kind of confusing. There's a similar situation that happens in Judges 17, verse 5, but it's more an idolatrous practice. And this might be the same thing. It might be kind of a similar idolatrous practice. I'm not 100% sure. Says the man Micah had a shrine and made ephod and household idols, and he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. So it's kind of a different situation, a little slightly different. So anyway. Yeah, he makes this ephod and he puts it back in his hometown, Ophrah. And it says that, says there in that verse that all Israel played Baal with it there.
Right.
Which is awful. It became a snare to Gideon.
Right.
And his household. So, God's word says that. It wasn't a good thing.
Right.
So it's kind of shameful, obviously. And he put it there because, you know, that was his hometown, and that's where he also had the altar set up. So I don't know what his thinking was. It's hard to know. But for the third part, what effect did this ephod have on Israel and the legacy of Gideon? So, like I just said, it wasn't good. And so in verse 28, this, the Midians were subdued, so there was peace in the land for 40 years. But, you know, kind of to Israel, I think, to me, it seems like they became complacent. And they just kind of fell back into that same idolatrous practice after that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so remembering in chapter 6, Gideon tore down that altar. So I'd like to think that there weren't any altars in Ophrah, but I don't know that. But I know he tore one down in chapter 6, his dad's altar. Anyone else? Question number 5. Lauren?
So Kaufman kind of theorized that you had Tabernacle and Shiloh, which was in Ephraim's territory. So we got kind of competing things going on, competing territories. Maybe it is like what happens later in Kings, where he wanted to have worship in his area. And I kind of started to try to put myself in, you know, what was Gideon's thinking. If you remember earlier, he had this interaction with the angel of the Lord, and, you know, he took his sacrifice and all that, burned it up. And so perhaps Gideon thinks that he has some sort of special relationship, and he has the right to usurp the Aaronic priesthood for whatever reason. He didn't, but perhaps that was his thinking. So it seems like he set this up, at least it looks like to me, to worship the Lord, but improperly.
Yeah. Yeah, I wondered about pride. I wondered about pride because he has had a special relationship with the Lord. And I got to believe Gideon's faith has been through the roof after what he's, and the 300 and Israel. You know, I would think that their faith would be really strong now. They're out from under the bondage of the Midianites. But then he said he wouldn't be king, but then he started acting like a king. And he started bringing in all this gold, these golden earrings to make this ephod. And you could argue that he deserved some of those riches, but what he did with them was the problem. Anyone else? Question number 5. Austin.
I agree with Lauren. I think not only in chapter 6 does he have the interaction with the angel of God, but he sets up an altar there as well after his interaction with the angel of God. And God tells him to sacrifice that bull that belonged to his father after he cuts down the altars of Baal and Asherah. So I think that's probably the case, that he is maybe with all good intentions, but with pride mixed in. And as it says there, it becomes a snare to Gideon and to his house. Now, I wonder if Gideon, there's a part of me that doubts that Gideon pursues after the way that Israel does and plays the harlot with it, as it says there, or falls to idolatry, or his house. I kind of wonder if maybe they're like, they don't get into it quite as much, but they don't do anything about it. That's maybe a possibility. But I think the more important thing here is in two short little verses, in 22 and 23, Gideon is given a chance. He has everyone's support, and all he has to do is say yes to completely change God's design about how he's supposed to rule over Israel, that this is a theocracy and not a monarchy. And all he has to do is say yes and just take on everything that they want him to take on here and completely take God out of the picture. And I don't wonder if he's not mentioned in Hebrews 11 in the Hall of Faith for this reason rather than all of his military victories. Because he remains true, even though we see later he falls, he has his sin, but he remains true to God's system initially. And had he not done that, the entire story of the children of Israel would have been completely different.
Right. So the 1,700 shekels of gold, it's about 50 pounds of gold that was collected in that garment. So that's what he had to work with to make this ephod. Anyone else on question number 5? All right, let's look at question number 6, Lauren. If you're up for it. How did Gideon end his life? What did Israel do immediately after Gideon died? What is significant with Israel forgetting not only God, but the household of Gideon as well?
Well, we see he was a very wealthy person. He had 70 sons and many wives. So he was very influential in Israel, especially in his area. We see that he continued to attempt to direct religion during his life, but it says he died at a good old age, so he lived well and lived long. The B part, what did Israel do immediately after Gideon died? Well, they went back to worshiping the Baals. That was one of his first acts we see here, is cuttering down the Baal altar, and
as soon as he's gone,
there it goes back up again. What is significant with Israel forgetting not only God, but the household of Gideon as well? We seem to see a connection between humans' respect for God and their respect for the fellow man. It doesn't seem insignificant that the whole of the law is love God and your brother as yourself. So we see that connection that connection between the love of God and love of
God. That was a better answer than I had. I appreciate that. Thank you. Anyone else on question number 6? Austin?
Briefly, we shouldn't overlook the importance of Joash being mentioned here. Not only the fact that he's called Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, which is the name that Joash gives him, but the fact that he's buried in the tomb of Joash, which almost makes him sound similar to other patriarchs in the children of Israel. They're buried in the tomb of David or whatever the case might be. So we shouldn't overlook that little fact.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting, this verse 31, making mention of this concubine at Shechem who bore Abimelech, who grew up to be a terrible king. I suppose Israel's first self-appointed king, Abimelech, and we'll consider this man a whole lot more in chapter 9. Abimelech means my father a king. Anyone else? Question number 6. If not, that brings our study to a close this evening. I appreciate the participation of everyone. Sorry for the technical problems. We'll get after that and see if we can get that fixed here before next week. Maybe.